Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Shira Springer. Let's remember the 17 people brutally shot and killed on Wednesday at the Marjorie Stoneham Douglas High School in Florida.
Alyssa Aladef, a 14-year-old soccer player.
Scott Beagle, 35, was the school's cross-country coach and geography teacher.
Martin Duque Anguiano, a 14-year-old freshman.
Nicholas Duarette, a 17-year-old senior, planned on attending the University of Indianapolis.
Aaron Feiss was the assistant football coach. He was 37.
Jamie Gutenberg, she was 14.
Chris Hickson, wrestling coach and athletic director, 49.
Luke Hoyer, 15. He played on the basketball team.
Kara Loughran was 14.
Gina Montalto, a member of the marching band, 14.
Joaquim Oliver came to the U.S. from Venezuela at the age of 3. He died at 17.
Elena Petty, 14, was in JROTC and aided in the Hurricane Irma cleanup.
Meadow Pollock was 18, and she'd planned on attending Lynn University this fall.
Helena Ramsey was 17.
Alex Schachter, 14, played trombone in the marching band.
Carmen Shentrup, 16, was a National Merit Scholarship semifinalist.
Peter Wang was in the JROTC program, and during the shooting, he held a door open so others could escape. He was 15.
The alleged shooter, Nicholas Cruz, confessed to police yesterday. He used a semi-automatic AR-15 rifle and faces 17 counts of premeditated murder, one for each of those killed. Let's turn now to our Week in Review guests. Charlie Chippio, a senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and head of Chippio Strategies. Hi, Charlie.
Hello.
And Susan Tracy. She's president of the Democratic consulting firm The Strategy Group and a former state rep. Susan, hi.
Thanks, Sherry.
Initial reactions. We're dealing yet again with another mass school shooting.
Yeah. Initial reactions. It's so hard to hear those names. I don't even know how to have an emotion anymore. We have been through this so many times, and I think all of us think this is the one. This is the one that's going to change it, and it's not. And I always say to myself, if Sandy Hook didn't change anything, how can anything change anything? It's so, so distressing.
It's just such an amazing feeling of powerlessness, because it seems so clear that nobody needs to be walking around with an assault rifle. No civilian needs to be walking around with an assault rifle. Yet it's the way it is, and it isn't going to change. There's so many levels to this too. I mean, just the fact that now it's coming out that, you know, they had reason to believe this kid was planning to go shoot up a school in January, and they don't follow up on it. And, I don't know. It's just so tragic on so many levels. And maybe the most tragic thing of all is that we all sit here and know that it's not going to change.
Yeah. I want to turn to the assault rifle used. Officials report that the AR-15 rifle used in the attack was bought legally in 2017 at Sunrise Tactical Supply in Florida. And according to the New York Times, an AR-15 is easier to buy than a handgun in Florida. At a vigil last night in Florida, Fred Gutenberg, the father of victim Jamie Gutenberg, said this.
I sent her to school yesterday. She was supposed to be safe. My job is to protect my children. And I sent my kid to school. What is unfathomable is Jamie took a bullet and is dead. I don't know what I do next. My wife is home. We are broken. But I can tell you, don't tell me there's no such thing as gun violence.
Absolutely heart-wrenching.
I heard it this morning, and I just couldn't get out of my head.
Yeah, and you know, that after you've said nothing will change, is there anything that you think that can be done? Are there any steps to be taken? I know on Twitter, one of the sort of resistance movements has people, you know, as soon as a congressperson or a senator says, you know, thoughts and prayers or something to that effect, they're attaching a link or, putting together a thread that says how much the NRA or gun-related causes have donated to that particular legislator. Is that enough? Will shaming legislators make a difference? What can be done? Susan, do you have an answer?
If I had an answer, I'd implement it immediately. But the thought that I have had over the last, I guess, on all of these, but I'm just at a breaking point on it, is I think people have got to become single-issue voters on this issue. And every candidate running for office needs to not just be asked if they will support an assault weapon ban, but if they actively move to make sure that it is taken up on the floor of the House and voted on. You can't hide behind, being supportive. You have to put pressure on to make leadership bring these things out for a vote and take a vote on it. And the only way I think we're going to be able to fight the NRA, because the money that they have is just insurmountable, but this is truly a moment when I think the grassroots movement of, and it's bipartisan, if you look at the numbers on support, they have got to make this a single issue, and we've got to hold people accountable, and they have to take this up for a vote. And that's the only thing I can come up with.
You know, and what makes me think, I heard this morning, actually, an interview with somebody who is covering the Olympics right now, and they were saying that, she was saying that both of her camera people that she's working with are conservative, former military, and they both are absolutely adamant that this is insane and this shouldn't happen anymore. But I think in a way they are the key, because they're NRA members and they need to stop giving them those dues.
You bet.
You know, and I.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting, we alluded to earlier the fact that Nicholas Cruz was someone who clearly there were signs that he was going to do something. Yep. You know, the FBI was alerted, friends, neighbors, those close to him suspected that this was a kid who could be a mass school shooter. And he himself had sent a message, I believe it was over YouTube, yep, that he wanted to be a professional school shooter. And so here's State Rep David Linsky yesterday. He is the sponsor of a bill on Beacon Hill that would let family members, judges, and caretakers temporarily suspend a person's ability to purchase a gun.
Certainly, we could probably do a better job of securing our schools, but the real way to prevent school violence, the real way to prevent people getting shot in schools, is to make sure that the people who have guns, who shouldn't have them, don't have those guns in the first place.
So, Charlie, is that a viable solution, you know, giving family members, judges, the ability to temporarily take away guns?
I mean, it helps, but the problem is that...
Is it a violation of Second Amendment rights is the other question.
Yeah, sure. And
we could argue whether assault weapons are covered by the Second Amendment.
Well, right, that's a good point. They certainly were not envisioned by the founding fathers. I think it's clear enough. That's clear enough. Just the problem with that is that there's nothing wrong with it. It's just that it's easy to do it here, where we already have strong gun laws. You know, the problem is not doing it here. The problem is doing it in the place where you don't have strong gun laws, where you don't have sort of the common sense stuff that's already in place.
Like Australia did as a country.
Right.
Australia, after,
was that 1996, right?
Yeah.
They
had
a mass shooting that just turned everything around, banned everything, nothing since.
And bought back what was out there. I mean, that was the other piece of it. They put like $500 million into buying back assault weapons that were out there.
And you talked earlier about grassroots leadership, people becoming single-issue voters.
Critical.
Is that, is it going to come both top-down and bottom-up? Or, do you think the real momentum this time around...
Nothing's coming top-down on this. This has got to be bottom-up. We have seen what is happening top-down. This is a bottom-up movement.
Look what's happened in the last day and a half. Trump has been tweeting that Governor Scott was there, and neither of them are saying anything about changing gun laws.
Nothing.
It's all the usual stuff about mental health and all,
And remember, Florida is where the Pulse nightclub happened.
Yeah.
And And then this happens? Like, they did nothing after that?
No.
Yeah, I believe there was a 23-year-old reporter in Florida who, who has been on the job for all of about a year and a half, and she said she has covered already in her short career three mass
listening
shootings.
To this 23-year-old woman, you felt like you were listening to some grizzled old 60-year-old. You know, she had just been so worn down by this.
Yeah, she was saying she's envious of her older colleagues who, yeah. you know, this was a once in a career occurrence yep. for them, and it's yeah. certainly not what it's yeah. been for her. Let's come closer to home and talk local politics. A new WBUR poll out this week has a few interesting findings. In the Democratic primary for the 7th Congressional District, incumbent Michael Capuano leads challenger Ayanna Pressley by 12 points among likely voters. Do those numbers surprise you or not? We'll start with you, Susan.
Well, I'm going to start by saying those are two great people. I like both Ayanna and Mike an awful lot. We're lucky to have them as public servants in our state in any way. I think this race is going to be a really interesting one to follow. And what strikes me about it is, you know, there's certainly this momentum, I believe, in this cycle of young women, minorities, millennials, feeling like they're going to get engaged. I think the real question for me on this race is going to be, do those voters feel that they need to be engaged in a Democratic primary? Or is that energy that we will see in a final election when people are really trying to put new blood in where it doesn't exist that supports all of the causes that I think young voters in this blue wave is looking for?
Charlie?
Well, I was surprised by it. And I guess when I saw the numbers and I looked deeper into the poll, I understood it better. But I guess for me, there was more just sort of a reflexive reaction that we have an all-Democratic delegation, and that they're there as long as they want, and they never lose. You know what I mean? But when you look at it, and you realize that it's you know, half of the voters in the district are in Boston, and that Pressley is winning in Boston. I guess it makes sense. I think also a large part of this is just that Ayanna Pressley has realized pretty quickly that just in terms of a political launch pad, that Boston City Council is probably not the best, the best place to be. So
she's an elected official.
And Charlie, you mentioned that Pressley is winning in Boston. To be more specific, she had an 11-point edge in the poll for the Boston numbers. Obviously, Capuano had the—
It was like 4-1.
Exactly, outside of Boston. So the question becomes, can Pressley get voters outside of Boston? You know, can she pull some of those support from some of those areas that are outside of the city? Do you think that that's doable, Susan?
Again, I think for me the question is in the primary, is it doable? You know, I think when and I don't know if you're Ayanna, you want to mobilize, as I said, women, young voters, minority voters, and you want to get them ginned up to show up. If you're Mike Capuano, you want to say, I'm a good liberal Democrat who fights for all of the things that you believe in. Is your energy, do you really want to spend your energy going after me? Mm-hmm. So, where the voters will come out on that, I don't know. But that's the question. You know, do you want to go after the, you know, liberal Democrat incumbent? Or do you want to bring new blood into that race?
And she has to try to
make— In a primary.
She has to try to make voters understand that in this case, the primary is really what matters.
And that's the race.
You know, that's the race.
And that's the challenge.
Yes.
And I want to touch very, very quickly on one other part of that poll. And it was regarding Amazon headquarters, the second Amazon headquarters. An overwhelming 71% of those polled said that they would want the second Amazon headquarters located here in Boston. Interesting to me, we brought up the Olympics earlier, very different than it was for the Boston, let's say the Boston Olympics 2024. What do you make of that enthusiasm, Charlie?
Well, look, I mean, I think I can understand it because I don't know that anybody who has spent more ink writing about how Olympics and convention centers and tax giveaways to businesses are a horrible deal for the most part. You know, I mean, this one, you know, let's see what the deal is, but I'm certainly interested. I mean, most of these things don't come with 50,000 jobs. You know, let's make sure that those jobs are real.
Yeah, let's see what the deal is, and yeah. also let's see what the tax incentives. Right. I know Susan Absolutely. And I were thinking along right. the same
Absolutely.
Lines. Exactly.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the public in the polling, they're not nuts about tax right. incentives being offered to Amazon. Now let's talk about a few local media stories. Let's start with the sale of the Boston Herald. The paper is now officially owned by Colorado media company Digital First Media. Today, a federal judge approved the sale. The price tag, just under $12 million. The company will keep 175 of the Herald's 240 workers. That's still a substantial cut. The company, the Digital First Media, also owns the Lowell Sun, the Fitchburg Sentinel and Enterprise, and hundreds of publications across the country. Here's Brian Whalen, president of the Newspaper Guild of Greater Boston.
The Herald's still alive, so it's going to continue on. That in itself is a positive. But let's just hope for the best.
Yeah, I was going to say, let's hope for the best because we don't know how much the Herald will be cut down or cut to size or cut back. How much can the Herald be cut or how much can be cut from the Herald before it's really a shadow of itself?
Well, look, I think you don't have to look very far to see that. They just fired the publisher in Fitchburg and now have a virtual newsroom going there. So, I mean, that sort of gives you an idea of how much they can be cut. The 240 down to 175 is the initial cut. I don't think they're going to stop there.
Still, it's important to have a two newspaper town, don't you think, Susan?
I do think it's important. I fear this purchase, though, because, if you dig past Digital First, what you're going to find is Alden Global Capital. This has essentially been purchased by a hedge fund. This is about making money and investments. It is not about news. It's not about local coverage. It's not about Boston and how do we support our town and challenge the globe. It's about making money, and that frightens me for the long run.
There's a very sobering op-ed in today's Globe about this that, if you read it, will scare you if you care about having two newspapers in this town.
Yeah.
Why don't you say sobering how, in your opinion?
Well, it's just Joshua Benton, who's the head of the Nieman program in Harvard, writes about how everybody in the newspaper business is going to cut and do all that kind of stuff. But at least some, if you have a chain like Gatehouse, who is in the running here, generally what they do is they make cuts and they obviously try to make it profitable, but they run newspapers. Whereas these folks, it seems like, may just want to get it profitable and then just sell it off. They don't seem to have any concern on the journalism side whatsoever.
Now, we also need to touch upon Tom Ashbrook, former host of the NPR show On Point, produced here at WBUR. Boston University, which owns WBUR's license, dismissed Ashbrook on Wednesday after an independent review verified claims that he had created an abusive work environment. I should also say that a second investigation to determine if he had violated the university's sexual misconduct policies found that his conduct did not constitute sexual harassment. Here's WBUR General Manager Charlie Kravitz.
Yes, it wasn't just me. We all failed to successfully address this issue, and I think we have to collectively take responsibility for that.
And Ashbrook today told Channel 2 this.
I wasn't feeling how my behavior was landing. I wasn't really taking it on board. And what I thought of as just, the rough and tumble of the news business, I don't know if it's times have changed or people have changed or I've changed, but it was perceived as more than rough and tumble. And that was a big sort of 2x4 up the side of the head for me.
Your reactions. We'll start with Susan.
First, I congratulate WBUR for sort of taking this on and taking yourselves on. I'm sure it's not easy to be covering yourself. So I give you credit for trying to be forthright and get that out there and talking about this today. What struck me on this one was, if I think about it in the context of a Me Too movement, that, and you state here, this is not about sexual harassment. It's about workplace, environment or whatever the right words are. But what struck me was that it's encouraging to me that the Me Too movement is not just about sexual harassment, but it is about people in power and how they treat the people they work with and what kind of an environment you can create for people to be in. And I think we'd all be better off if we were treated respectfully in all our environments. So I give you credit for that.
Yeah, and before I get to you, Charlie, I just want to play this from Joshua Benton. He's director.
It's the guy who wrote the op-ed.
Exactly. Yes, I was getting there, Charlie. He's the director of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard, and he told us that because we're listener-supported public radio, the public cares even more about our internal workings. And this is what he said.
Our leadership really needs to evaluate how they could let this happen under their noses. I mean, this On Point was not a weekend show on a college radio station. It's a nationally distributed flagship of one of the largest public radio stations in America. I can say just from being a journalist in Boston that Ashbrook had a reputation for a very long time as a yeller, as a screamer, as a bully.
Charlie, what about this idea that everyone knew and still nothing was done until now?
Well, you know, it is, what can you say? It's very disturbing, and it's very, you know, you also have that deja vu. That's something that we've heard a lot in a lot of different areas, it seems. And that is something that has to be changed. And really, there's no other way to do it than to make those people not feel safe, you know, feel like they can't get away with it.
And let's now switch gears and wrap up with our hubbubs.
Those lighten things up.
Yeah, I was going to say we are going to lighten things up. I have a feeling quite a bit. You know, those hubbubs are those brief stories or events that caught our attention this week. Susan, do you want to kick off with your hubbub?
Sure. I think this has been a really hard week, right? A lot of tough stuff going on, including, which we didn't talk about, the United States Senate. Unable to do anything for Dreamers and for DACA. And so an event that stood out for me is the Olympics. And Charlie, I think you're going to talk Olympics too. It's sort of the bright spot going on in our life this week. But to me, when I saw Chloe Kim, that 17-year-old snowboarder who won gold and wrapped herself in the American flag, and her dad, and who was a South Korean immigrant who came here with $800.
I know where you're going with this. The American dream.
The American dream, yeah. You bet. And dad said the American dream. I said, you know what? Everyone pay attention to that.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful story and one that everyone's well-placed to
beautiful
hear.
Beautiful story and an important message.
You bet.
Charlie, take us to Pyeongchang, too.
Yes, I have another American as apple pie view of this. You know, the I know that all the Radio Boston listeners who heard my 2016 hubbub about the number of condoms distributed at the Summer Olympics in Rio have been hoping for a Pyeongchang update.
Oh, good.
And I would, of course, never let them down. It turns out that Pyeongchang will indeed set a Winter Olympics record with 110,000 condoms being made available to the athletes, or an average of 2.3 per athlete per day. This, however, still falls short of the record set in Rio, where a mind-boggling 450,000 were on hand. 450,000 condoms were on hand, which averaged out to 2.6 per athlete per day. Interesting as all this may be, it mostly just leaves me feeling very, very old, and the mere thought of it makes me crave a nap.
Okay. I am going to do, I'm the sports person, but I'm going to do something completely non-sports. I want to end with a bit of a public service announcement about potholes. Hopefully you and your cars will thank me. The Massachusetts Department of Transportation has a pothole repair dashboard, and it lets you know where Mass DOT workers are repairing potholes on state roads and highways. This week was a big week for Mass DOT with more than 600 potholes repaired. Hooray. If you have a pothole to report, we'll have a link to the dashboard on our website, and from there, instructions on how to report your personal pothole nemesis. Charlie Chipio, thank you. Charlie Chipio is a senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and head of Chipio Strategies. Thank you for coming in. And Susan Tracy, president of the Democratic consulting firm The Strategy Group and a former state rep. Thank you as well for joining us.
Thanks, Shira.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Shira Springer, and this is Radio Boston.